Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more of America This Week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
We're back. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. I am Carrie Weber, along with Father Matt Malone, and we are speaking with Dan Barry, author of The Boys in the Bunkhouse, Servitude and Salvation in the Heartland. And this is a topic that began as an article for you for the New York Times. At what point when you were reporting this, did you think, okay, this is going to be a book? There's more to this than I can put in one article.
The story ran in the New York Times in March of 2014, and my initial draft that I handed in to the executive editor, Dean Baquet, was about 16,000 words, which is long for a newspaper.
Basically a book, yeah.
So he said, this is great, cut it in half at least. And so I did that, and so I realized that there were so many stories and anecdotes and nuances that could be explored. So after the story ran, you know, I thought about it and said, let's keep going. And so I finagled some book contract and kept going.
I want to ask you about Willie Levi. One of these men, you opened the book with him and you closed the book with him. And his story is really the story of this entire group of men from despair to hope. Mm-hmm. And he had, as you describe it, the worst possible job. You know, he had to remove these turkeys from these pens or crates or whatever, and who were violently abusing him because they're so strong and all the rest. And then he would have to hang them on these hooks to go in to be slaughtered. But he had this way of kind of soothing them into this process, didn't he?
He did. It's kind of beautiful in a way. He would talk to them. He would sing to them. He'd say, okay, Tom, okay, quieten down. And he said he would pat their bellies. So he would grab the turkeys out of the crate, properly turn them upside down. But he would do it in such a gentle way. He's effectively leading them to slaughter. But he's doing it, he's saying, it's your time, and he's rubbing their bellies and he's calming them down. And it's a beautiful, upsetting moment, but that's what he was apparently gifted at. He could, everyone I talked to said Levi could talk turkey. He could talk turkey.
It's like turkey whisperer.
Oh, turkey whisperer, exactly. And it isn't that kind of gobble-gobble that we do as children. Right. He can do the entire turkey call.
And he would do this thousands of times over every day, year after year. Is there also a kind of self hypnosis happening in that process? You know, that that act of talking to them and engaging with them is also allowing him to kind of endure this.
I think that's quite wise. I think that is true. I will say though, you know, if you were to stand at an assembly line day after day for 35 years, notwithstanding that you're getting paid the same pay, it takes a wear and tear on your body, notwithstanding your emotional state. These men suffered damage to their legs, to their backs, but also to their hands specifically, because every day they're doing this repetitive job of reaching into these carcasses and pulling the gizzards out effectively, and their hands became constricted. So when they were rescued many years later, many of them had to have operations on the hands just so that they could move properly and normally.
So what happened to him eventually?
To Levi?
Yeah.
Well, let's say that Levi is representing all of the men,
sure.
Okay? And he's typical in that he, was left at the state institution gates when he was 12, and it was heartbreaking. He didn't want to go there. He wept. And for the rest of his life, he talked about wanting to go back home to Orange, Texas. And of course, I went to Orange, Texas, and there are no Levi's left. No one would remember him. Mm. His Orange of 1960 is gone, okay? And so he lived in this bunkhouse for many, many years. And finally in 2009, the system effectively shut down. It was done. The owners were old. One had passed away. The other one wanted to retire. And so the decision was made to retire the men, to retire Levi and all the other men. So notice they don't have a choice in whether they're going to be retired.
Right.
And they were going to go back to, you know, average at best nursing homes in Texas, which is another form of institutionalization. And now that these men are in their 50s, 60s, 70s, some of them, and that's it. And so some families were still involved in the lives of these men. And a sister called up the owners and said, hey, Keith has been working for you guys for 35 years. How much money does he have in the bank? And the answer was $86. And she exploded. And she called everybody in Iowa save the National Guard. And she called a local reporter, an investigative reporter named Clark Kaufman at the Des Moines Register. And the garbage can was tipped over. The men were taken out of there immediately by the state authorities and rescued. Okay. And so what happened after that was that lawsuit that we spoke about, but also the challenge of assessing the men physically and emotionally and then reintegrating them back into society. And that happened in the cases of many of the men. Some of them wound up in, quite frankly, lousy nursing homes in Texas. Many of them remained in Iowa. By the way, that's not their home state. They're all from Texas.
Right.
And they live in Waterloo, Iowa. They live in homes, in suburban settings. And they work if they want to work. They don't work if they don't want to work. They go to church. They have girlfriends. That was another thing they were denied. They were not allowed to have any kind of intimate relations with anybody. And so Levi has a girlfriend. He's decided not to work. And every week he goes to a nightclub that is open in the afternoons, and he performs karaoke. He sings. He's quite gifted as a singer.
You accompanied him there?
Yes, I went there one night, and he wouldn't tell me what he was going to sing. And so there were several men with intellectual disability who were participating in karaoke nights. So Raymond Vaughn sang Jailhouse Rock, but his version is repeating the words Jailhouse Rock 52 times to the rhythms of the song.
Wow.
And it was beautiful. But Levi wouldn't tell me what he was going to sing. And he finally got up and he accepted the microphone. And the words of the song are scrolling down on the monitor, but he can't read. And so what he sang was What a Wonderful World. You know, the Sam Cooke classic. You know, it's beautiful. Don't know much about history.
Right.
Don't know much about economy. So,
right.
Yeah.
But I do know that I love you, and if you love me too, what a wonderful world.
What a wonderful world.
Yeah.
It's a killer.
Yeah.
Now, the lawsuit that you mentioned, how did that affect the broader spectrum of disability rights, either in Iowa or Texas or elsewhere? Was there an effect based on the results of that suit?
Yes, it's had resonance throughout the system. And by the way, that lawsuit was focusing on first the denial of some wages that they should have received, but also it's centered on the loss of enjoyment of life, which is a wonderful, heartbreaking phrase. They were denied the enjoyment of life for 35 odd years. After the lawsuit was won by the EEOC, it was this statement about the rights of people with disability in the workplace. And so it's affecting all sorts of actions and policies now. The Department of Justice and its Civil Rights Division is taking a hard, hard look, for example, at sheltered workshops. And you think about the term sheltered workshop, you know, they're meant to integrate people with disability, yet what we're really doing is segregating them and putting them in a building on the side of some industrial park. And there are some benefits to sheltered workshops, but they are being reevaluated, let's say, by the Department of Justice. That's just one example.
Right.
Now, I don't ask this in a self-righteous way, but one of the questions that keeps coming up in the book is, you know, where is the community in all of this? I mean, this is a community, very, very small community, a couple hundred people, right? And you keep thinking to yourself, well, they must know what is going on here. And I mean, where were they in all of this? Where was their conscience? Where was their judgment?
I know. You know, Matt, it's that we want black and white, but life is so gray.
Mm.
And this schoolhouse sat on a hill in this very small town. And the windows were boarded up in later years, okay? It was not an inviting place. But the people had gone into this bunkhouse or the schoolhouse in the very early years, and it looked well-run and it looked clean. So they were never invited back. So it declined inside, but it looked the same outside, except the windows are boarded up and the front door is padlocked. And there was this kind of like disconnection. And I think it's natural in a weird way. I think they're representative. The people of Adelissa, that's the name of the small town, are representative of all of us. A familiarity developed where you would see Willie Levi day after day after day after day, and you might notice, hey, by the way, you know, he's walking funny, or his hands look crooked. Or you'd see Jeff Long, and he'd have blood on the side of his mouth, and it was because his dental work was cutting into his mouth, and no one was addressing it for a long time. And you would think, well, they're being taken care of. Government has it. It's okay. I still love Willie Levi. I'll still dance with him at the tavern on Friday nights. And to me, it's telling us that we have to remain vigilant for those among us who are vulnerable, that we can't accept things, that we have to, you know, keep our eyes open. And that wasn't happening in adolescence, even though these people were good people.
Right. The need for that true accompaniment, really, all throughout those years, people that needed people to be with them where they were and help them out, not just kind of parachute in and dance and then go back home.
That's right.
Not that that's a bad thing. Not that dancing with somebody is in itself, you know, something to be looked down upon, but we're called to a deeper relationship. But that's difficult, especially with vulnerable populations that require real commitment and require us to kind of move out of ourselves and maybe some discomfort in our own lives.
Right. And the assumption that, oh, the government knows what's going on there and then they're
right.
being taken care of.
That thing that's so easy for all of us to do, which is, I'm sure somebody else is taking care of that. Mm-hmm. I have to go home.
That's right.
And did you speak with members of the community after all of this came to light? Was there some sense of, oh, gosh, I wish I had seen this. I wish I had known.
Yes. I'd have to say there's great remorse and great regret, wishing they could do it all over again. I do think that that's the case. But what they all say to a person was, the men never complained. Okay, you'd see Willie Levi at the post office or Henry Wilkins down at the tavern, and they never complained. And I struggled with that question. And I thought, well, first of all, the men don't want to appear weak. You know, if they're dancing with a farmer's wife or a rancher's wife at the tavern, he wants to be seen just as manly and just as grown up as anybody else, and rightly so. So I finally spoke with an expert, and she said, no, you don't understand. These men never knew anything better, okay?
Right.
So they have difficult childhoods. They spend their formative years in state institutions, and they were not good at state institutions. And then here comes this paternal figure who says, come and live with me on the ranch, okay? And then we're going to go to Iowa. And we're going to live in a schoolhouse. It's going to be like a big dormitory. It's going to be a fraternity. Every Friday I'll give you $5 and we'll go to the mini mart. You can have anything you want. That was better than anything they had known previously. So that's why they never complained.
And it's also, but that also puts the onus back on them, on the victim, right? Because battered spouses often don't complain, right?
That's exactly right.
Right. Now, since this book came out, there's been a lot of attention drawn both to this story, but other stories that you're now hearing about and discovering that are similar to it in elsewhere in the country.
You know, after the story ran in the New York Times, two social workers who were very much with these men. You know, part of the story is how people, once it was exposed, rose to the moment and really, really went out of their ways to take care of these men. And two social workers in Iowa were telling me, this isn't the only case. And I'm saying, come on, this is a one-off. This is a curio. And they said, no. You know, one of the men, Carl, he has a brother named Leon, and he used to be in the same system, but he's now in South Carolina. We came across some records, and payments are being sent, Social Security disability payments being sent to a Leon Jones and the address was Lewis Rich Boulevard in Newberry, South Carolina. And so many of your listeners will recognize Lewis Rich as one of the most prominent meat processing companies in the country. And I didn't want to go. I'll be honest with you. I didn't want to go. They kept nagging me, quite frankly. And my Irish Catholic guilt got the better of me. And I told my editor, look, I got to go to Newberry, South Carolina, and it may be only to knock on a door. And so he said, go. That's the wonder of working at the New York Times, quite frankly. And so I went to Newberry, South Carolina, drove down Lewis Rich Boulevard, and to my left was a turkey processing plant, and to my right was a bunkhouse, a series of mobile homes in a bunkhouse setting. And I knocked on the door, and here comes Leon Jones. His hands are constricted. He's about 65. He shows me where he lives. He lives in this this open room, and his space is maybe about 12 square feet. He has a bed and a small desk. And he says, and I get to hang my hats right here. And I said, well, where do you work, Leon? He said, I work across the street. And his job was to pick up the DOAs. He was to pick up the dead turkeys that come in on the trucks that wind up on the floor. That was his job. And that was 2014 in December. And so since that, and I wrote that story, since then, you know, there are other stories about employees of turkey meat processing plants not being allowed to step away from the assembly line. So they have to, you know, they relieve themselves. So they have to wear, you know, diapers or something. That's happening now.
I mean, that's real. And the book is The Boys in the Bunkhouse, Servitude and Salvation in the Heartland. It's an amazing read. But ends on a hopeful note, thanks be to God. At the very least, I can assure you, you will strongly consider vegetarianism by the end of this book.
Reconsider Thanksgiving.
Right, exactly. Dan Barry, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much.
When we come back, we'll be joined by our editor-at-large, Father Jim Martin, to talk about the end of commencement season and what he's learned going to and fro our Jesuit colleges and universities. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to hear the full show every week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.